session number 9998, Reel 2.
Sir Peter Marcel, Reel 2. Can you tell me what your duties were as commanding officer of a ferry corps?
As I remember it, we had about 40 pilots and quite a number of engineers and MT officers and cooks and so on, and some operations staff who really kept answering telephones and sorting out pilots' movements and taxi aircraft and so on. But I think as CO, it was a question of general discipline, seeing that the jobs were done and the right people did them. I do remember every morning as the information came in on teleprinters as to what aircraft we should move, I always planned the day's operations, and then when I'd organized who should do what, where the aircraft should go for, was handed over to an operations officer, a chap called Smithy, as I remember it. He was a stockbroker by trade. And he then saw that everybody went off, and I was able to join in the flying that way. But I don't think it was a particularly onerous job, because everybody was so keen. And it was a small unit. You knew everybody personally, by Christian names and so on. So it was a very exciting and enormous fun flying these beautiful aeroplanes all over the place. In fact, the only things I remember as being very unhappy was when a pilot was killed. I can remember three pilots who were killed flying, two of them by flying in weather that was they shouldn't have been, but their keenness to get on made them take risks and they just flew into the ground. And I also remember one who was a chap called Jack Burgle, who I think was flying a Blenheim out to an Air Force base. And I think he just flew too slowly and it stalled and crashed. And he was killed. And his brother came in by chance shortly afterwards delivering an airplane. And I had the very unhappy job of telling him about his brother's death. But when pilots died, that was really very unhappy because you had to inform parents and nearest relatives. But other than that, it was a very happy time, very exciting time. You didn't really think about breaks or holidays or anything like that. There was too much going on.
What impact would it make on the other pilots when somebody was killed?
Well, it certainly made an impact for a bit. But everybody was so sort of busy and so stretched themselves, I don't believe it had any very lasting effect. We just had to get on with the job. You didn't think about not flying or anything like that. You merely said, well, I must learn, I must be prepared to stop pushing on if the weather's too bad.
Did you as commander have occasion to caution people about their attitudes to flying in various types of weather?
Well, yes, that was a sort of continuous process. I do remember that I was hauled up to headquarters and said that we had been delivering aircraft very well, but we had had, I think it was two fatalities, and that I must be much, much stricter about seeing that people didn't push on, that it was more important to get the aircraft there a little late than to get both a broken aircraft and a killed pilot. So that I obviously was showing too much enthusiasm to push on regardless, but it was always a personal judgment. We had our own Met officer, and they were RAF-based Met officers, and they used to plot the weather as best they could with the limited information, and we each of us had to make our own judgment as to whether we could fly or not. There were no really strict rules, and you couldn't anyway enforce them. Because once you're in your aircraft with no radio, no control at all, each person made up his own mind. But if you found the weather getting bad, you hoped pilots were landing. And if they didn't, you'd inquire afterwards what they were doing, how they got on. But there was no black and white rules about it.
Would you discipline pilots for not being cautious enough?
I don't remember. I think we must have done, but it was really saying your priority is to get it there safely, as soon as you can, but safely. And to a certain extent, the importance of the deliveries were taken into account. I mean, some aircraft, it wasn't terribly important if they didn't get there quickly. And you would take rather more chances if it was an urgent delivery to a squadron or to aircraft that were short in of supply. They wanted them there quickly. Obviously, you would push on a little bit harder.
Did you ever find you had pilots who lost their nerve and who wouldn't go out in?
Oh, they did vary a lot. Some were very cautious. I don't remember any who you really say lost their nerve. I think one or two of them didn't feel they could cope with the bigger aircraft, and you would keep them to the smaller ones, or even to ferrying pilots around, flying the taxi aircraft. But I don't remember it as a major issue.
You mentioned earlier about the pilots having various disabilities, perhaps they'd been wounded or so on.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult was this for you as commanding officer to keep everybody together? And
oh, not difficult at all. There was a great camaraderie in the place. Everybody was out to do the same thing, all doing a job they loved doing. They all loved flying. And here they were having a chance of flying aircraft they never thought they'd see the inside of. So there was no difficulty about keenness at all. And as far as disabilities, some people had quite severe disabilities, but if they'd been passed to fly a certain class of aircraft, that was it. You say, that's fine, carry on. And I really don't think there were any troubles like that. Some people, for physical reasons, couldn't fly the bigger aircraft. But there was one particular chap who had one eye and only one arm, or at least only one hand, and he couldn't fly twin-engined aircraft at all. But he used to fly Spitfires and Hurricanes most remarkably. But those were the rather more extreme cases.
Was age ever a problem amongst the pilots?
I suppose, yes, but not very great. As I think I said earlier, we had an air marshal and an admiral, both of whom were well beyond retirement age, but who could fly and were keen, and they were flying. I don't think we had any really ancient ones. I mean, I think into 60s, yes. But I don't think anything beyond the early 60s. But that's a slight guess from a long way off now.
And they didn't have any problems coping with the speed of the aircraft?
Well, I think, again, they didn't fly the most advanced aircraft of the day. They kept to the slightly easier ones, slower ones. Though I don't think any of them were really difficult, so long as your reactions were reasonably quick and you had a sort of aptitude for flying. I know once when I'd been flying things like Halifaxes and Stirlings and all the bigger fighters, and I went to the cinema one day when it was very bad weather, and there was a film about flying aircraft, and you saw these very complicated cockpits, and I thought, gosh, they must be clever to be flying that kind of thing. And suddenly I think, good Lord, I flew one of those this morning. And you know, if you look at it from the outside, it looks terribly complex and difficult. When you were doing it as a job, you wanted a bit of information and you merely looked at the instruments that gave it to you, and you didn't think about the mass of them. And I think once you got used to that, the complication of the aircraft was not awfully important.
What about varying nationalities? Did you have other nationalities in
the tour? Oh, yes. We had two super Poles, I remember very well, but I think they were mostly at White Waltham. One had been an airline pilot, and the other, I think, had been in the Polish Air Force, and he wasn't fit to fly in the Polish squadrons over here. They were super chaps. We had a Frenchman, Maurice Arlet, tremendously keen. And he was one of the first pilots to go into Paris towards the end of the war. I'm sure we had some others. Oh, yes, we had a, I think it was a Brazilian airline pilot. Quite a range.
Did you have any Americans?
Oh, a lot of Americans. I would have thought of that first, yes. At White Waltham, I know we had six or seven of them. And they changed quite a bit. But I think ATA must have had 50 or 60 Americans through. They were great characters, some of them. Again, they were ones who wanted to fly these lovely aircraft, and here was a chance of doing it. And at that time, we were finding it difficult to find enough pilots with enough background to convert easily. And it wasn't until we got our Americans in that we found that we really had to start recruiting pilots to fly ab initio and train them ab initio.
How well did the various nationalities mix?
Oh, very well. There was really no nationality problem that I can remember at all. They all got on well together.
What about language?
Oh, they could all speak English. Some with a bit of an accent, but there was no real language barrier. I don't think it had been possible otherwise.
Did you have any women pilots at Ratcliffe?
Yes, quite a number. I can't remember just how many, but we must have had seven or eight of them anyway. And you treated them just like the men. There was really no difference at all.
Was there any prejudice against women pilots?
No, I don't think so. No, I think that the women felt that they ought to have perhaps a little more choice of aircraft, but they may have felt that they weren't given as much opportunity as the men. I don't think it was true, but I do remember them saying, well, when can I fly this, when can I fly that?
As commanding officer, how important was it for you to keep an eye on each pilot in terms of their progression?
You mean when they were ready to go on to another time? I think you did that almost all wanting to move on to the next grade and therefore all wanting conversion courses, and you soon found those who showed the aptitude and reliability and so on from their records and the way they were flying. And as you were watching what they were doing every day, knew what they'd achieved, it wasn't a difficult thing. And as soon as you felt they were fit, you'd tell the school that so-and-so was, in your view, ready for conversion, and he'd go off and have a course.
Did you have occasion to hold anyone back?
I don't remember. I should think almost for certain, but because everybody was keen to get onto the bigger aircraft, and some people simply hadn't the adaptability. Perfectly okay within their limits, but and you didn't want everybody flying the big aircraft. You only needed a certain number. So you didn't.
You mentioned maintaining discipline. Could mm-hmm. you tell me more about discipline in ATA as a pool commander?
I never looked upon it as a problem. We were a keen band of, in spirit, amateurs, I think, doing a job which we wanted to do. There was a war on, everybody wanting to do their bit. And I don't think really there was any real trouble about discipline. Obviously there were one or two who would go too far, but I don't remember it as a major problem.
What were the worst things that a pilot could do?
Oh, I think to sort of push on when he shouldn't, take an aircraft and go where he shouldn't for his own pleasure, or start stunting, you know, playing around instead of just delivering it safely from A to B. Many of them were young, and therefore there was a considerable tendency to do that, and there was a tendency for them to shoot lines afterwards, and if they did, well, you said, here, you're not there to do that. But again, I don't think there were any real major problems. I don't remember any, anyway.
Did you have a system of punishment?
Not that I know of, no. I think the most you would do would be to say, well, we shall keep off flying until we feel you're reliable, or at least flying the kind of aircraft that you'd like to. I don't think there was any fining or, you know, discipline in the sense of you were demoted. I don't remember any demotions.
How difficult was it for you to maintain a pool of civilians? We didn't have service regulations.
I don't think it was particularly difficult. You had headquarters support on any of the problems you needed, they would deal with supplies. You had freedom to get supplies locally, but always within a sort of standard set by headquarters. And we were in touch with headquarters very often, COs. So that there wasn't any great problem. You had to have engineers, of course, keeping the ferry aircraft running and doing odd repairs on the ones that were landed overnight. But on the whole, everybody was keen to do the job, and it was a question of seeing people didn't try and do too much rather than get them to do enough.
What was the attitude towards drinking?
Oh, I think people were keen on parties, but on the whole, I don't think there was I don't remember any cases of people doing drinking and driving sort of thing. One didn't think about it then very much anyway. But I know people sometimes had a party and didn't feel too good next morning, and they'd fly then, but they wouldn't try and have a lot of drinks in the middle of the day and then go off flying.
If a pilot wished to leave for personal reasons or family considerations, would he or she be able to? I mean, change pools?
Oh, well, that was really a matter for headquarters. And I think quite a number did. On the whole, I think they wanted to fit people in where they would be happiest and therefore able to work best. But, of course, the scope was pretty limited. So there wasn't a vast amount of movement between pools. On the whole, people stayed in the same pool. I think the COs probably moved about in the early days more. But once they got established at a pool, I know a lot of them went right through as CO of that pool.
What about your own flying during this time as CO?
Well, I did all I could, that's really all you could say. I couldn't fly quite as much as the others, obviously, but it wasn't too bad at Ratcliffe. As you see, you could, if you wanted to, pinch some of the nicest flights. But I did a lot of flying while I was at Ratcliffe.
What about staying overnight whilst you were at Ratcliffe?
Well, obviously, I didn't want to stay away overnight more than I could help as CO. And so I used to get back somehow if I possibly could. I'm sure I did stay away a number of nights. But on the whole, as CO, you could choose the flights which you thought would get you back.
Would you share duties with your second in command?
Yes, yeah, so he had to be able to do the same thing as the CO. He would sort of, if I wasn't doing the sorting out of programs for the day, he would do it. And if both of us gone, the operations officer would do it. But you didn't want him doing too much because he didn't know the pilots as well from a flying point of view.
What about time off? Did you have a day off?
I believe you did. I don't remember very much about that. I'm sure we did. I think most pilots certainly had a day off a week. And then they had occasional weekends, and of course during the year they'd have proper holidays. And later on in the war, the medical officer, a chap called Dr. Barber, was very strict about it. He said you must ensure that pilots have proper holidays. Because certainly later on you got pilots who were getting a bit wound up and stale and overpressed, and he simply sent them off on the holidays.
What time off did you take?
Don't really remember. I only remember being sent off on holiday once by him, but that was later on when I'd had a forced landing and I'd been working hard. But otherwise I don't really remember holidays very much.
Can you tell me about the accident rate whilst you were at Ratcliffe?
Well, I've spoken about the disaster ones. I don't think the accident rate was bad otherwise. It was, you had a few occasions when something went wrong. One engine out of two perhaps packed up. Occasionally there were single engine ones where the engine just stopped for some reason. On the whole, people get down safely. So I don't think it was particularly bad. There were lots of little incidents, but they were part of the ferrying job. If you had an incident, you'd report it so that it could be put right before the aircraft was used again.
What about the accident committee? Did you sit on that?
I think I did for a bit, but that was at headquarters only. And that became a very important part of the system, because they took the view that the great thing was to learn from the accident, and that was more important than anything else, to see that either things were made better or it being prevented from happening again.
Did you yourself have any incidents?
Yes, I can only remember one where I was flying a very old Master, I think it was. I forget where it was going, but somewhere over Gloucester way, I know the engine suddenly stopped and just landed with wheels up in a cornfield. And that was treated as an accident, quite rightly, and I had to explain what had happened. And it was gone through, but I'd done the right things, apparently, so that was all right. Nothing you could do about it. It was a very old aeroplane, I think.
Was anybody to blame for allowing you to fly the aeroplane?
I don't really remember. It was signed out by a maintenance unit to go somewhere for some service, and one simply said, well, that happened.
How confident did you feel in the ground engineer's checks before you took off?
On the whole, very. I think on the whole that the system was good. At the factories, the engineers, AID staff, were really accepting the aircraft on behalf of the government and were very strict, and you were pretty certain they were all right. The maintenance units, of course, there they were merely being issued out to the squadrons, and on the whole, again, the standard was high. It was the older ones coming back from squadrons or ones which had had a misfortune at some point that you weren't quite so happy about. The smaller repair units, I think, were the most worrying. You were a little bit more careful.
Could you refuse to take an aeroplane?
I suppose you could. You had to give a reason if you did. But if you weren't happy about something, you were certainly expected to say why and insist that it was put right before you flew it.
Did you ever have occasion to do that?
Don't remember. It was a long time ago.
How long did you stay at Ratcliffe?
Without looking through the books, I'm not quite sure. Shall we look? Perhaps a little less. I must have gone to White Waltham, which was headquarters, sometime in 1943. So perhaps I was at Ratcliffe a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. I think I went as chief instructor, though I'd never instructed, and there were two schools for training, a more advanced one and an elementary one, a TAME, I think. And then they reorganized the ranking altogether, the senior ranking, and they had four senior commanders, operations, who was Philip Wills, administration, which was Ben Bathurst, women pilots, Pauline Gower, and then they had director of training and recruitment, which was my job. And then it became a little more formalized. We had two engineering schools at White Waltham, I think, and three flying training schools, plus a unit which was teaching flying boat training somewhere in Ireland, I think it was. So that I unfortunately didn't have so much flying, which was sad. But it was very interesting in that one was involved in recruiting mostly women for ab initio training. Though I remember we had a number of selection boards with the RAF to try and find pilots. We had an RAF staff officers, and I went there from the ATA point of view to select pilots, but I don't think we got very many. And in the end, we came to recruiting women who'd not flown. I don't think there was any difficulty in finding numbers, but it was difficult to select them because they had to learn very quickly, and they therefore had to have aptitude. And we did find that those who drove cars well and also those who rode horses well seemed to have an aptitude. I don't remember how many we took on, but it was quite a number. And they went to the primary training school and then to the middle-sized one and then to the more advanced one, but doing courses and going and doing some ferrying on the class that they'd been passed in and then coming back when they got more experience.
Was there any means in those days of a simulated flight test for ab initio people?
I don't think we used that at all. I know I did do, personally, an RAF blind flying course just to see whether it had any practical application with ATA, but as we, one of the cardinal rules was that we didn't have navigators, we didn't have radio, we therefore had to fly within contact with the ground, in sight of the ground, and it wasn't really suitable, so that we didn't even at the end of the war have blind flying training or anything like that. And I don't think we used simulators at all. It was simply practical flying on different classes of aircraft. They'd go and do solos with them in the school aircraft and then start ferrying.
With the selection policy, did you have any basic physical requirements as regards size?
Age? No, no. We had some tiny pilots who were still... They had to take extra cushions and things, I think, to get to see out. And we had a few long ones, but no, there was no limitations like that.
What about the RAF? I mean, why were you recruiting directly from the RAF?
I think there was a time when they had pilots who they didn't feel could go on with operations anymore, and they thought they might be useful ferrying. We had a few. I don't think they ever stayed very long. I really don't know why. We even had one or two who'd been badly burned, fighter pilots who'd been badly burned. But again, they didn't stay awfully long. But I don't know enough about it to say what happened to them. I don't think any got fully integrated into the system. Perhaps the services, the life was so different that they just didn't feel they could fit.
When you were selected to become chief instructor and then director for training, had you shown an interest in the training side?
No. Not at all. I enjoyed the flying too much. No, I think this was simply they decided they wanted to rationalise the whole organisation and looked for somebody they thought might be able to do it. Not looking for an instructor, but somebody who would know what was wanted from the pilots in this peculiar ferrying operation. I do know that because of my practical experience, I made one or two alterations in the training, like the way they approached with fighters to come into land, that you could never see very well ahead. And the old way was that you simply flew straight in, and in Spitfires and things, you really couldn't see straight ahead. So it was really rather dangerous. But this had never been really accepted by those who were just teaching. And I changed the rules then so that you came in on a curve and could see where you were going to land. That kind of thing.
As chief instructor, how many instructors did you have under you?
Oh, I should think 20, something like that. It was always slightly embarrassing to take up a chief instructor and say, I want you to do this. Although I was director of training, they felt that they knew much more about flying, as they did, than I did. But I found that they accepted as long as you talked sense and told them what you really clearly wanted and why, they weren't difficult at all.
Had there been any major problems with the training program?
No, I don't think so. I think we had a very good team running right away through, and they were jolly efficient. Also the engineering schools. I think towards the end, pilots had rather more technical training than early on, learning about boosts and revs and power and fuel consumption, that kind of thing.
How important did you think it was for pilots to have a technical training?
Well, I thought it was a help on the basic stuff. I didn't think it was any point in having advanced technical training, because I didn't see how it would help them. But the whole thing was basically practical. How could you train somebody to move an aircraft safely from A to B? Not one particular aircraft, but a whole range of aircrafts. And that had certain things you needed to know. But that was all.